Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, a daytime shooting in Uptown seriously wounds a visiting CEO and raises questions of safety. Former state GOP chairman and congressman Robin Hayes pleads guilty to lying to the FBI. He faces jail time. Mecklenburg County's plan to collect on past due ambulance bills goes on pause as citizens react negatively. And the proposed sales tax for the arts takes center stage as those for and against campaign for your votes. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and those reporters include Steve Harrison, political reporter for WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Glenn Berkins is here. He's the editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com.
Good morning.
Katie Peralta joins us, she is the senior editor and reporter for the Charlotte Agenda. Welcome back again this week.
Good morning.
And we are all on the radio and on Facebook Live with Joe Bruno, a reporter from WSOC TV Channel 9 Eyewitness News. You're on TV right now. Are you feeling like
you're home? Everyone.
Okay. On Monday, John Holliday, he's a 74-year-old founder and CEO of a company called DisposeRx. That's a medicine disposal company based in Sanford, North Carolina, was in the wrong place at the wrong time in Uptown Charlotte. Police and firefighters had blocked off College Street at the Bank of America building because there was a fire at Rooster's wood-fired kitchen in that building. Around 4 p.m., gunfire erupted, and Mr. Holliday was hit as he was walking past the epicenter on his way to a meeting. The randomness of this shooting, an innocent bystander, has raised questions about safety in Uptown Charlotte. The police insist Uptown is safe. Is it?
I think Uptown is safe, especially.
There is gunfire uptown. There was a bullet hole through this window not too many years ago.
There is gunfire uptown from time to time. The CMPD released some numbers later that day showing that violent crime in its central district, which includes Uptown, South End, and a little bit, I think, of the Eastway neighborhood. That violent crime in that area is up
8%.
So I guess more disturbing, though, homicides went from 1 last year to, I think, 7 this year. So shootings and homicides in that area, in those very popular entertainment areas, mm-hmm. has gone up.
Raheem Shacklett, a 16-year-old Georgia teenager, is charged with attempted murder in that shooting. He was also charged with possession of a stolen firearm, possession of a firearm by a minor, and fighting with at least one person in a public place that disturbed the peace. CMPD Captain Julie Berry from that downtown district, the Central District, reiterated several times during a press conference that Uptown Charlotte is safe.
It's not about location. I mean, Charlotte is facing the same struggles that any large metropolitan city is facing right now when young people are making these really bad decisions. So it's not the location. It's just these people who are making bad decisions trying to settle a verbal argument or a small physical argument with gunfire.
Young people making bad decisions randomly in random locations. That means no place is safe.
I'm not sure I would say no place is safe because most of the time these homicides are directed at an individual. This was a very unfortunate situation where a man was walking to a business meeting,
right,
as thousands or tens of thousands of people do every day, and he happened to be struck. Fortunately, that is a very rare occasion here in Charlotte anywhere.
I think the randomness of this crime, as well as others like it, really get the attention of people in a way that is noteworthy. I mean, yesterday we had our 82nd homicide of the year, and no one really talks about where that was or who it was. But it's always like, can this happen to me? Remember last spring when Kendall Crank, the mother of two, was just driving home or driving to school or something, and she was kind of caught in random gunfire. Mm-hmm. And the question remains, like, you know, she wasn't doing anything. That could have been me. It was 5:15 in the afternoon. So I don't think we can live our lives in fear and have that kind of in the back of our minds all the time, because this does happen everywhere. But we pay more attention to it when it happens in Uptown or when it happens in South End or when it's random.
I want to challenge that homicide count as well. I know that earlier this year, CMPD took a couple homicides off that list because they said the people were not charged. It doesn't really matter if someone was charged with a crime. It's still a homicide. A homicide simply means that one human took another human's life.
So you're saying the number is higher?
If they do not count those where people are not charged, yes, the number is higher. Absolutely.
Okay. Now, that seems odd that they would count the people. It's not about the people who fired the gun. It's about the people who die.
Absolutely.
If there's good news at all in this, the good news is that police and fire were on the scene fighting that fire at Roosters, and therefore they were able to incredibly quickly respond to Mr. Holliday's injuries. Still, he was deemed earlier this week in critical condition, and his company's website has confirmed that even as late as yesterday afternoon at about 5:30 that he was still in critical condition. We have no update on that from anybody?
No update.
Okay. There were three other men arrested in this incident. What have they been charged with, and are they still in custody? That seems to be a key question these days. Do they stay in custody?
I don't know about the custody part, but they were charged with a simple affray, as you mentioned, fighting in public in a way that disturbed the peace. I'm pretty sure that's would that be a misdemeanor? It's not a very serious crime. I would be shocked if they're still in custody.
One of the accounts that I read said that they had an argument near the epicenter, and the argument had ended pretty much, and they were walking away when the shooter simply drew a gun and fired.
That's the understanding I have, too, and that's the impression CMPD gave at the press conference.
So Raheem Chaklet, who allegedly fired this gun, the 16-year-old from Georgia, was charged with attempted murder. Is that because he fired the gun at one of his cohorts in an attempt to murder him, or because he actually hit an innocent bystander who may lose his life?
I could only speculate on why they chose that charge.
So there was also this fire at Roosters that broke out about an hour earlier at about 3 p.m. On Monday. Do we know what the cause was? How much damage was caused, and when Roosters might be open?
It was an accidental kitchen fire, about $1.5 million worth of damage, and Roosters is indefinitely closed right now.
Okay. And also, I guess when they had that fire, they evacuated the buildings, right?
They did, but it was, I think some employees in that tower were a little frustrated because they didn't know exactly what was going on, right?
But I mean, that would flood the streets with people, would it not?
It would.
So are we fortunate that only one person was hit in this gunfire incident? All right, let's move on to Robin Hayes. He's the former chair of the state Republican Party, a former congressman, and he pled guilty this week to lying to the FBI. Remind us, what is that case about, Steve?
That is about a Durham businessman, Greg Lindberg, who owns Global Bankers Insurance Group. And he, according to the federal government, was upset that the insurance commission there was a deputy who felt unfairly regulating, supervising his business. So Lindberg allegedly was trying to funnel campaign contributions to the insurance commissioner, Mike Causey, in exchange for him removing this deputy. And the allegation is that he and Hayes were kind of working in cahoots, that he was going to give money to the state Republican Party to get around campaign contribution limits, and then the state Republican Party would funnel that into Causey's campaign. What they didn't know is that Causey went to the FBI. He agreed to wear a wire through much of 2018. Hayes was asked in an interview in August, right, August 2018, had he ever spoken to Mike Causey about Greg Lindberg? Had he ever spoken to him about personnel issues?
The interview was with the FBI.
FBI, yeah. And Hayes said he had not. And so that was this plea was specifically about that interview.
So he pled guilty to lying to the FBI, but he was also charged with other counts, and the prosecutors dropped, I think, four other charges in exchange for his plea. What were the other charges?
I mean, those stemmed to the directing the money, the funneling the campaign contributions to skirt state state limits on how much you can give.
Various bribery and wire fraud charges.
And this is turning out to be one of the state's largest corruption scandals ever. Is that right?
I think it would have to definitely be in the top three or four. I mean, it's just staggering, the amount of money and the people involved, the brazenness of it.
Is this a normal state of affairs that we just don't know about most of these things, or is this the tip of the iceberg, or is this uncommon in North Carolina, or do we know?
I think we know about this because the insurance commissioner wore a wire, and he really came forward and was the definition of a public servant here. So it does make me fear that there might be more of this happening. People just don't speak up.
Is Mike Causey, the insurance commissioner, a Republican or a Democrat?
He is a Republican.
And he just announced yesterday he's running for re-election and kind of mentioned, honesty and integrity in his kickoff speech.
Good for him. Hayes has agreed, obviously, to cooperate with the investigation. Will he be expected to testify against Lindbergh or Lineberg and Palermo? And who is the third?
Gray.
The
expectation is if he needed, he should testify. And as experts have said, the more he cooperates, the less prison sentence he could possibly look at when all is said and done.
The maximum would be 5 years. The federal government, they're recommending the low end, which would be, I guess, up to 6 months. So it'll be, like Joe said, how helpful he is and how willing to work with them. I mean, maybe that's 6 months all the way down to zero.
Yeah. UNC Charlotte former basketball coach Jeff Mullen happens to be a longtime friend of Robin Hayes, who was at Wednesday's plea hearing.
I just patted him on the back and said, good luck. We all know the politics today is a strange animal.
What has this got to do with politics?
It has absolutely nothing to do with politics. I was just sitting here thinking the same thing. The fact that he may not serve any time in some ways is an indictment of the duality of our criminal justice system, because we have other people who don't have the powerful connections who would definitely go to prison.
Yeah. What the others pled not guilty to these charges, which seems to be either brave or stupid in the face of somebody who has turned state's evidence essentially on this. So what do they face? What kind of time do they face if, in fact, they are found guilty, unless they really truly believe they didn't do anything wrong?
Serious time. Upwards more than a decade.
More than a decade.
Yes, these are serious charges.
And so they face the trial in November. They are asking for this case to be moved to February because their lawyers say this case is so complex and so complicated that they can't possibly be ready for trial by November. How long has this thing been going on? A long time, it seems.
Long time. Since summer, I believe, correct?
And when did Robin Hayes decide he would cooperate, therefore accelerating all of this, one would imagine?
Well, the plea agreement came out last Friday, so probably within the last couple of weeks.
Okay. So I guess we'll follow this beginning in November or in February, right, depending upon what the court decides about all of this. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about a bunch of things, including Medic, because the county was going to go in and get some money back from people who have been using the ambulance service and not paying for it. And a lot of people, we talked about this yesterday on the show for a good better part of the hour. A lot of people don't know you have to pay for this. But anyway, they put all that on hold because of public reaction. And I think you and Steve were at that meeting.
Yes.
So we'll get your reaction to what happened at that county commission meeting this week. And the Arts and Council, the Arts Sales Tax is coming your way. It's going to be on a ballot near you very shortly. So what's the status of that? That and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's Friday. It's the news roundup. That explains why Joe Bruno is here from Channel 9, Eyewitness News, why Glenn Birkins is here from QCityMetro.com, why Katie Peralta is here, although she's here a lot, from the Charlotte Agenda, and Steve Harrison, who works for us. That's why he's here. He was told to be here at 9 o'clock, and he's here. You're a good employee. Thank you for being here. 2 weeks ago, Mecklenburg County announced that they they would be going after people who were delinquent over 120 days on paying bills to Medic, the ambulance service. They were planning to use what were described as, quote, advanced tax collection methods, including garnishment of wages or taking money directly from people's accounts. Well, slow down now, because that did not sit well with some folks, including Steffi Hamrick, who's an advocate for the disabled. Here's what she had to say at this week's county commission meeting.
How dare you? Have you lost your humanity entirely, taking the most vulnerable members of our community, people who will die without access to care, and making us beg you for our lives? Because when we have to come to you and beg you not to take away our benefits, our bank accounts, our tax refunds, money we need to survive, that's what you make us do.
And she wasn't the only speaker against this. Here's Tara Long.
I'm terrified for the lives that will be lost because people are afraid to call for an ambulance because they can't pay for it. We don't think about money when we call the fire or the police department. Why should we when we're sick?
That is a key argument throughout the health care debate that we have been having in this country now for, what, 15, 20 years? Some people now call Uber when they need to go to a hospital, which is not a good thing in an emergency situation. Long and others say the solution to the debt problem Medic faces is enacting a Medicare for All system at the federal level. Maybe, but what about now?
That's just not an option for the county right now. Really, to collect the missing fees, they can raise rates, they could pass it on to the tax collector to garnish wages, or they can increase county funding. And we found out Tuesday night, Medic is out $123 million going back to 2012 due to unpaid ambulance fees.
Let's go back. This is very confusing for me, and we did a show on it yesterday, and we couldn't get anybody from Medic to come on. So let's go back, because most municipalities 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the counties, municipalities paid for the ambulance service through tax dollars. You were never charged, and they ran the ambulance service. Who runs Medic?
Medic is a county agency, but they have their own governance board.
But you pay the bill in it, and you pay the bill in Atlanta.
Partially funded by the county, so there is tax money involved.
Okay. But there's an agreement between the two hospitals, Atrium and Novant, to what? Man the ambulances? And of course, they have to receive compensation for the medical personnel on board, one would think. Is that how it works?
There's a compensation for the people on board, for the services that are rendered, for the equipment that they use.
So do you think most citizens are aware?
No.
That this is not a taxpayer-based free service.
Not only do I think they're not aware of that this isn't free, I don't think they're aware of how much it costs. They kind of went into some of the pricing at Tuesday's meeting, and I think the cheapest they mentioned was about $700, and that's if you pre-schedule the ambulance.
And I think it's, I mean, I just think it's interesting. Like Joe talked about the $123 million figure, which came out at the meeting, and you think the numbers in this situation are so big and the problem so complex, you think, well, what would Medic's situation be if it had was only out 50 million, only out 100? You know what I mean? This is just like I can't even comprehend.
And if you're out $123 million, what took you so long to come forward and say, hey, we can't, this is not sustainable? How long has this been going on again?
Going back to 2012, that $123 million.
So it's been 7 years. It took you 7 years to build up to $123 million. What took you so long to say, hey, red flag here.
Well, that's kind of Medic's argument, and the county's argument, and kind of people supporting Medic is that Joe Pinner, who heads Medic, said, I don't like to do this. This is the worst part of my job.
Right.
The idea we've been waiting and waiting, but it's reached a point, a breaking point. We have to do something.
And Commissioner Trevor Fuller sympathized with the people in the audience who were having a problem with this policy change, and he noted that the very fact that the conversation was being had at the commission meeting was a problem.
We should not have anyone have to think twice about calling Medic in an emergency. And so I do think it is our job to make sure that people are confident that they can call medic when they have an emergency.
So they had made in a previous meeting a decision to do what they were about to do, and then they had this backlash. Did they not anticipate the backlash?
Actually, they never directly approved this policy. They approved a budget which included funding for new positions that allows them to carry out this policy, but some commissioners were frustrated that this kind of just came up on them and they didn't really have a say in this issue.
And I think one other thing that's interesting is that if you separate whether it's the – put aside for a minute whether it's the right decision to go to the tax collector or not. In government, it's important to make things happen. It's important to kind of like think about the timing of things. When do we bring this out? When do we discuss it? This comes a month before this vote on the quarter-cent sales tax for the arts. So you've got this arts tax, you know, looming in a few weeks, and then all of a sudden we talk about $123 million in unpaid medical bills, people suffering, people who can't pay. It was just so hard to have these issues at the same meeting, and it was questionable timing. Yeah. To have them, to put them both on the plate at the same time.
But won't that always be the case when you have funding proposed for something that is optional? Or discretionary expenses versus emergency, mandatory things that must be handled, isn't that always going to be an impossible balance? It's always going to be there.
Yes, I just think having this discussion with Medic 4 weeks before the vote on the arts tax was especially just tricky.
And I would go back to what Joe said, not just the timing in terms of the proximity to the referendum, but there was never any public discussion before it took effect. Oh. And that needs to really be driven home. We're having this discussion after it was rolled out. This was announced via press release. There was never any public discussion, public hearing.
Well, that was the reason for my question. I mean, how could they not anticipate a backlash like this when this is affecting people who really can't afford to have their wages garnished or have their bank accounts dipped into? Otherwise, one would presume they would be paying these bills.
So they are saying that if you receive Medicaid benefits, VA benefits, hospice benefits, charitable contributions, not sure what the charitable qualifications are, Steve, you may, but if you fall into those categories, they are not going after you. They really want to focus on the people who can pay but are choosing not to.
So yesterday we did 40 minutes on this topic, and we talked about how changes in ambulance services, how the changes in how they were funded here and around the country, and we delved into the waste and the unfairness and the unknowables and the profiteering, to use one expert's words, that sometimes arises through the privatization of ambulance service, which is partially true here, that they overcharge because they can and because they have to make up for the people who cannot pay. But we also received an email yesterday from a guy who identified himself as Brad, a paramedic, he said, for over 10 years. Here's what he wrote. He wrote, just based on my personal calculation, about 80% of the people that we see do not need an ambulance, which can cost between $1,000 and $1,270, depending on the patient's condition. Most of these people, he says, are perfectly capable of taking themselves to the hospital or to their primary care physicians. They say to me, I want to go to the hospital in an ambulance because I'll be seen faster. And many people, he continues, use an ambulance as a free taxi to go to the place where their doctors are. He admits that he has become jaded over the years, but do we know if abuse like this is a significant, this is anecdotal, do we know if it's become a significant part of the problem here? Are people abusing the system? He says essentially that they have no intention of paying.
I don't know if I would call it abuse when a lot of time people use emergency services as their primary care because they don't have any other primary care. And this goes back to the conversation of universal health care. It's not exactly something that the county can fix in a one vote session, but this is a problem because emergency care is really, really expensive, not just the ambulance part of it, but the services when you get to the hospital.
We keep being told that. We've had this conversation now. I'm old and I'm tired of this conversation because it just, on the face of it, doesn't make any friggin' sense to me. That emergency services are monstrously expensive, and they're really driving up the cost of health care, and we need to get a handle on it, and people need to stop using them when they don't have to. But most people who use them don't have an option.
Right.
So we don't seem to be able or willing to solve that part of the equation. Why not?
I mean, so many reasons. Like, a lot of, maybe you go to the hospital because you have a whooping cough or something, and that's something that someone's doctor would usually, I don't know. This is just an example, but I think at the end of the day, you can't really blame people for being ignorant about emergency services or the costs. It's not like they're trying to abuse the system. This appears to be their only option. And yes, education obviously needs to be part of it then, but so does primary care. And it is not an easy solution.
So the plans for this garnishing of wages and dipping into bank accounts has been put on hold, and they've asked county staff to come back with alternatives, options. Options for what? Options for funding the $123 million loss, or options for fixing this problem going forward?
Raising rates, increasing county funding.
How will raising rates solve this problem?
They got to make up that $123 million. But, you know, they could maybe go back to the old system. I imagine that could be an option on the table. The first file was supposed to be passed on to the tax collector today. But because of that discussion on Tuesday, that is indefinitely on hold.
I'm really fuzzy on this, and maybe you remember, Steve or Glenn, because you've both been here a long time. But why did we change? Why did we move to the system we have now? Do anybody remember?
That is before my time. It was like mid-90s.
Okay. 1996, yes.
Okay. So we're nearing November, Election Day. Early voting, by the way, begins October the 16th, which is right around the corner. And on the ballot will be a referendum on whether voters want to have that quarter-cent sales tax that Steve alluded to a moment ago. The money would go to arts, parks, and greenways. There has been much discussion about who would administer the arts portion of this, because the parks and greenways are run already by the government, but the arts are not. In fact, the county commission was scheduled to decide whether the Arts and Science Council board might be revamped and how the organization would be governed should they have to administer tax money, which is what this would be. Did they make a decision?
They did, partially. They passed a resolution that spelled out a little bit how the money would be spent. Earlier this month, or earlier last, in early September, the original plan was for the county to collect the tax money, to send that money to the ASC, and the ASC would distribute it. Trevor Fuller and Vilma Leek had concerns about that. They wanted the county to have the final say. They wanted the ASC to make recommendations and those recommendations to come back to the county and for them to improve, for them to vote yes or no. Earlier this week, that kind of went away, and it's back to the original plan of the money goes to the ASC, the ASC decides.
Okay. Overall, this sales tax increase could bring in as much as $50 million. Eric Spanberg, our colleague on this program who works for the Charlotte Business Journal, tweeted recently that Commissioner Vilma Leek says 45% of the money going to the arts is too much. Is that conversation continuing?
Oh, yes. People are coming out strongly both for and against, since this is kind of the biggest issue on the ballots in November, since most issues were kind of decided in the primaries this year. So people are super impassioned about this one, because kind of on both sides, and I think that's really interesting, the folks who are against this, it's sort of a hodgepodge. You know, you've got the super conservative folks who are going to vote against a tax increase no matter what. And then there are folks like Pat Cotham who basically, I mean, she has a lot of critiques about this thing, but she's uncomfortable with everything from the timing of it right after the property revaluation to the kind of loosey-goosey, in her words, nature of the distribution of the funds to the makeup of the ASC. I mean, Cotham and others have called the ASC's staff bloated. They've criticized their techniques for fundraising over the years. So there are a number of issues, and there are a number of different kinds of folks who are coming together against it.
At the same time, though, that conversation about the allocation should have been held months ago. Those concerns about 45%, that number is locked in. We are a month away from the election.
45% of the discussion we've got, how the arts portion of the money might be handled by some new kind of administration at the Arts and Science Council. This is going on as we are preparing to vote in just a couple of days on this. This is really screwed up, it seems to me. Is it? Or is it just my imagination?
No, I mean, that's one of the biggest arguments against this. There's no set plan.
So I've seen the ads because I'm on the computer all day. So I've seen the ads from supporting the tax increase. They're being pushed out by the Partnership for a Better Mecklenburg, formed with the support of the ASC, I believe. I have a question about that. The school, when the schools are up for bonds, they cannot advocate. They cannot advertise, please say yes to the bonds. They can push out an informational campaign about the benefits of people voting for the bonds, but they can't say, please vote yes on the bonds, because they're part of the county. The ASC can do this. If they're going to get county money, they can advocate for their own money?
That's a great question.
They are a nonprofit, so they are a non-governmental organization.
But they're going to get government money.
They would, and they do today, but they would be... You know, they would be like they are today and would be in the future, kind of like a contractor. They would, they would, and that's kind of one of the, that's kind of, I think, an important question is they would receive, I think, in the first year, $23 million from the tax, but as a nonprofit, it's not, they're not public. You wouldn't really have any idea what goes on inside.
So the opposition has also set up a website, no salestaxhike.com. Are they running advertising? I haven't seen that yet.
They just debuted this website, I believe, this week. This effort is led by former County Commissioner Matthew Ridenour.
Right.
And they are starting to get the word out a bit more. They had an informational session last night to kick off their campaign at Legion Brewing in South Park. And I think we'll be hearing a lot more from these folks. I mean, probably people have noticed, like, the yard signs and stuff like that for the... folks in favor of the sales tax.
Where's the money coming from on both sides for the advertising and the yard signs and the websites, et cetera?
I think the money, it's kind of clear to see where a lot of this money is coming from on the supporter side because you have pretty big names behind it. I mean, on the for side, you have big names like Hugh McCall and like the Charlotte Regional Business Association, the Carolina Panthers support the sales tax hike. I'm not saying that's where all the money is coming from, but I will say that they have certainly more name recognition and heft, I guess, at this point in their campaign.
The Business Journal reported a while back, I think, that the Koch brothers were going to contribute money for the opposition.
And with that, we must stop because it's time for a break. We'll be right back with more of the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hey, y'all, this is Tommy Tomlinson. On this week's episode of Southbound, we talked to Rhiannon Giddens. She's one of the commentators on Kim Burns' new documentary on country music. And she's a musician who explores roots music of all kinds. You can find this and every episode of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org.
Support for Southbound comes from Southeast Radiation Oncology Group.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison is here. He's a reporter for WFAE News. Our political reporter, Glenn Birkins, is editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. Katie Peralta is with us, senior editor and reporter for Charlotte Agenda. And Joe Bruno, reporter for WSOC-TV Channel 9, Eyewitness News. Before we move on from this referendum, which will be on the ballot beginning October the 16th, because that's when early voting begins for funding for the arts, a reminder that the referendum will not say anything about where the money is intended to go, arts, parks, and recreation, because by state law, it cannot. It's only going to ask voters, would they be okay with a quarter-cent sales tax hike? And a lot of voters, don't you think a lot of voters will go into the ballot box and be surprised by this and know nothing about this and know nothing about why, and if they do know about it, they don't probably know why the ASC needs this money. They don't know that their long-time successful fundraising paradigm doesn't work anymore. will they know what they're voting for or against?
In a lot of ways, I think that's why there's so much more pressure on the for side to raise large chunks of money and invest in this race than the opposition side, because to the uneducated voter, if they just see on the ballot, do you want to raise the sales tax, I think most of them will press no if they don't know what it's going
for. And that's what happened. This a quarter cent sales tax was on the ballot in 2014, I think. More than 60% said no. So...
And one of the reasons they blame for that is because there wasn't this educational campaign to inform the voters at what their choice is.
Okay. County commissioners also got involved this week in a discussion about windows. No, not the operating system, but actual windows on the 11th floor of the government building where security happens to be in the process of being upgraded. What about the windows, Joe?
I could not believe what I stumbled into, because this discussion was taking place in the basement of the government center before closed session.
No windows there, right?
I think I was the only member of the public there that didn't work for the county. And I was there just to find out what the security enhancements would be for the 11th floor. And they spent like 2 minutes discussing that. You'll have to be buzzed in.
The 11th floor is where the county commissioners have their offices and where county officials have their, I mean.
Yes, like county management.
County management.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the new security systems, which I can wrap up in a couple seconds, is they would have to be buzzed in, visitors. The receptionist would be outside. They would let the people inside.
Very 21st century.
Yes. And then most of the discussion was on which county commissioners and should county commissioners have offices with windows in 2021. And some county commissioners are very passionate about this issue. They want an office with windows. And Susan Hardin proposed taking away offices from staff members so that all county commissioners have an office with a window. And County Manager Dina DiIorio was not having that, because she's like, these staff members spend 50 hours a week in their office. Some of you are never up here. So if you want things to be equitable, I'll just give you all interior offices. No one gets a window.
So Joe,
that's pretty brave.
When this conversation was going on, did they know you were there?
Yes.
It's like, when the press is there, no, do not have this conversation.
Anyway. Yeah, people were glancing at me like, are you hearing this right now?
Okay, bottom line, who gets the windows?
Nobody knows. It's the county manager's decision, so it's looking like some people may get windows, some will not, and this will be a battle for the 2021
commissioners. Yeah, put a TV screen up and have a camera pointed outside. You can see outside. All right, Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden is getting into the education business. He's taking voter education into the county jail to let inmates know about their rights to vote in the November election. This is another in a series of things that he's done in the jail since taking office that are apparently aimed at restoring, what, dignity and
I think he would certainly use that word. This is about informing people who are in county jail of their rights to vote. If you are in jail and you have not been yet been convicted, or you're serving time in jail for a misdemeanor, you by law can vote.
Yeah.
And what he's doing, he's working with a nonprofit called You Can Vote, and they're going to be going into the county jails to inform inmates of what their rights are.
Do we know how many people are in jail right now, or on average, who are just waiting trial? They haven't been convicted of anything.
Last Sunday, I got a figure of about 1,600 people in county jail. Of those, more than half were pretrial, and I think about 12% were there for misdemeanors. So we're talking well over 60, probably approaching 70% of those.
So people. How would this work? He's going to go in there and he's going to tell them about, or people on his behalf will go in and tell these folks about their voting rights. How will it actually work if they want to vote?
Well, those who anticipate being there on election day, they will be able to order absentee ballots and vote ahead of the election through absentee ballots.
Okay. Is there any pushback on this?
Haven't heard any so far.
All right. The 9th Congressional District was back in the news this week because the President of the United States was spreading fake news about the election and CNN to U.S. diplomats at the United Nations. Joe, do tell.
The president allegedly told diplomats of the United Nations that CNN built this large $2 million studio in the 9th District for the election between Dan Bishop and Dan McCready.
Did he get that information from Fox News? Surely they didn't.
I don't know where he got that information because I was sitting next to the CNN reporter who was assigned to cover Dan McCready. We were in a conference room in a hotel. It was a small room. There were stale candies that were too sweet to be mints and too bland to be Jolly Ranchers. There was tap water that had a metallic taste to it. And there was a lack of electrical outlets so bad that I had to bring in a power strip from our live truck, and reporters were plugging into that so they could have power for their laptops. There was no beautiful $2 million studio for CNN. If there was one of those, I would have loved to have participated in that
and
action.
I think the president implied, right, they built the $2 million studio, but then when it appeared McCready was going to lose, they destroyed it. And it's just all gone. And it's in a dumpster somewhere in the 9th District.
Yeah, right? Somewhere between pieces, South Park and Blaine County. Yeah,
this is becoming alarmingly concerning. I'm not joking about this. This is alarming. Trump also said that Bishop was down 17 points before he campaigned for him on the night before the election. And that is also not true, because there were no published polls that show Bishop behind by more than a few points. And in fact, strategists for both campaigns have said the race was always close. Again, where does he get his information?
Good question.
I think maybe Bishop was behind by 70 points in a poll of McCready voters. No, I don't know. Okay. I mean, I'm not sure where that came from.
Former Vice President Joe Biden, I believe, is at the moment still the front runner for Democrats. That may change because Elizabeth Warren is closing in fast, but not in South Carolina, evidently. There's a new Winthrop poll of South Carolina voters with less than 5 months to go before the primary there. What does it reveal?
Right now, in the Winthrop poll, Joe Biden is in first with 37%. Elizabeth Warren is at 17%. If you look at just at African-American voters, which will be, I think, 3 years ago, we're about 60% of the electorate in the Democratic primary. Biden's lead is even larger. Warren was in Rock Hill last Saturday at a campaign event at Clinton College, a historically black school. Biden had also campaigned there. When Biden was there, Biden's crowd was about 50% white, 50% African-American. When Warren was at the same place, she had a much larger crowd, but it was, I would say, probably 80 to 90% white. And so for her, that will be the challenge.
The poll also reveals something else. Despite the fact that Biden is still leading among African Americans as their favorite candidate, 54% of white Democrats in South Carolina say that beating Trump was their biggest motivator, while only 35% of black voters feel that way. Most black voters say they want to vote for someone who shares their views.
And that person is probably not Donald Trump. But very interesting as well. The other thing that I found very interesting is that the two black candidates in this race scored single digits, even with black voters. There's an old trope that blacks vote based on color, and that's simply not true. And this poll demonstrates it in a very stark way.
South Carolina is one of those states that has the Republican Party there has said there will be no Republican primary for president, locking out their own Mark Sanford and Bill Weld from Massachusetts and the third guy whose name escapes me at the moment from having a contest prior to the party convention in 2020 here in Charlotte. But now there's a lawsuit being filed by a Republican, a former Republican South Carolina Congressman Bob Inglis. He's joined a lawsuit by the Protect Democracy Project, which calls itself a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to preventing American democracy from declining into a more authoritarian form of government. They need to work on their elevator speech. This is not the first time that primaries have been canceled, is it, by the parties?
No, this has happened before, and in the lawsuit, The plaintiffs acknowledge that the state Republican Party has the right to do this, mm-hmm. that they don't have to hold the primary, but they contend that the way they did it, they did not follow their own rules and moving too fast. So that's really what the lawsuit's about.
And I think what they're trying to do is really avoid a primary challenge. Whether it's been Democrat or Republican, when there's been a primary challenge of an incumbent president, it has not bode well for that for that president.
But do they have a ghost of a chance of winning this lawsuit?
I would think not. Okay. But
all right. Well, we'll see. Yeah. We'll have to find out. Last week, we talked about the resignation of Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina's CEO Patrick Conway after his DUI and the conduct that followed his arrest. The company was in negotiations to merge with another Oregon-based firm. This week, we learned those talks are over. Why, Katie?
Well, it I think stemmed from the fact that there was maybe a loss of trust, I guess you could say, between the two companies, because Blue Cross Blue Shield was criticized for basically knowing about the severity of the incident that happened this summer and essentially covering it up or not being fully transparent about it. And then, you know, after the fact, there was still some protection of his job to a certain extent until this video came out that was pretty damning that showed him swerving, and we learned that his daughters were in the back seat, and, you know, it was called off.
So we'll move on because it's been called off. Lake Arbor, we've been talking about impending evictions of these are low-income people who are in an apartment complex that's designed for low-income people, and they're under the gun to renovate the complex, evidently, because it doesn't meet code. And so a lot of people are facing eviction because they have to move out while they renovate. And this has been going on for months. And Tuesday, the first in a series of eviction trials began. What happened at the trials?
Most of them were continued to a later date. About 38 Lake Arbor families will be in court between last Tuesday and this coming Tuesday. And I think attorneys are expecting for most of them, they will continue to ask for more time to give residents more time to find somewhere else to live. But in some cases, these attorneys can maybe countersue for financial compensation if they have a case where these requests for repairs were not addressed.
And at most of these eviction hearings around the state, as I understand it, the people who own the units being rented usually have legal representation. The tenants usually can't afford it and don't have it. But there's $800,000 that's been put aside by the county commission for legal aid to offer services to Lake Arbor tenants. Are they being taken up on that?
Yes, and legal aid is able to really set up at the courthouse. From what I understand, the judge even makes an announcement and says, hey, legal aid is here. If you don't have representation, you can meet with them for free screening and see if you qualify for representation.
Brooklyn Village is the much-delayed Second Ward project that would be built in and around much of Marshall Park. There have been several hurdles that have slowed things down. This week, City Council delayed a vote on revising the agreement they have with the county and extending the county's deadline to sell the park to a developer. And now BK Partners, the developer out of New York, has said that if the city doesn't approve the agreements, there could be serious consequences. Like what?
Basically, an abandonment of the project, possibly. I mean, a huge delay, obviously, in the start of the project. The developer accused officials of basically trying to sabotage this massive $683 million project that we have been talking about for what seems like decades already. Unless this thing is figured out at a pretty quickly. And I think there are still a lot of outstanding questions and details to be figured out, including, you know, protections for minority-owned businesses, the number of affordable housing units on the property, how much green space to protect, et cetera. So I don't know if there is an end in sight right now.
You were here on Wednesday to talk about business developments, and one of the things we wanted to talk about that we didn't get to then, we're about to get to now very quickly because we're out of time, and that is Brew Public. We have all these breweries going up. Brew Public is a company that delivered beer first to consumers and then to businesses, and now they've gone bankrupt. Why?
Are we
falling out of love with beer?
Absolutely not. They they stopped doing home delivery in, I think, late 2017. And there are a number of outlets, including The Observer, The Agenda, national outlets like The New York Times, kind of like fawned over this company. They seemed like it was the next cool thing, kind of making waves in Charlotte's fledgling venture capital scene. Turns out things were not as great as they appeared. The company got into some real huge debt over the years, and they found themselves falling behind on the debt. They weren't able to pay it back to both suppliers and to employees, and they had to file Chapter 7. And so their debts are up to like $500,000. And so it's, you know, lesson is, if it seems too good to be true,
it is.
Maybe it is.
Well, the Panthers are 2-2. Let's hope that's not too good to be true, because they play again this Sunday. And then next Sunday morning at 9 a.m., they will be playing in London. Is that going to do anything for Charlotte? We'll find out. We'll talk about that next week. Steve Harrison, Glenn Birkins, Katie Peralta, Joe Bruno. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.